I didn't get to do this last week because Sam was teaching, but it is kind of weird. We haven't done a Bible class in like this in person in a year, and over a year, and so that is that's exciting. I get to see all of your faces, and I get to know if I'm making any sense at all by your reactions. and so that's nice. That's nice to have that interaction and that feedback. We are looking at, or continuing our look at, the Gospel of Mark, and we are currently in chapter 15, and we're almost done. I mean, we have chapter 15. We haven't gotten to the crucifixion yet. Of course, we're getting there. We're close, and we are going to get to the resurrection soon, and what a fitting time for that to happen. This time of year. So I have on the board there, I have this, if you've been following along with the live streams, this very familiar slide that I'm just going to continue using because I like how it comes out, and it works well for the website when I upload it to that instead of putting it on the whiteboard here. So hopefully that is... hopefully it's easy to follow for everybody. all right, so we've finished this slide just about. There are just a few last things here with leading Jesus out. So looking at verses 15 through, or rather 16 through 20, we saw that they were leading Jesus out of the, and mocking him, and leading Jesus out of the, the Praetorium, the Praetorium, and they're taking him to Golgotha, and so we see here on this section that there's a section here that Mark leaves out, but John goes into a little bit more detail, and the reason why I wanted to bring this part up. And it's been a couple weeks because I've been out for the baby. So to remind everybody, there's this section here that in John chapter 19, verses 4 through, let's turn there real quick. And, you know, our goal is to focus on Mark, of course. So, you know, we're trying to, excursions into other gospel accounts is not our goal with this class. But because of this, because of what happens here, it makes sense something that happens later in chapter 15 at the crucifixion. So I wanted to bring this up. John chapter 19 verses... verse 9, or starting verse 8. Therefore, when Pilate heard that saying, he was the more afraid. So remember, he was saying in verse 7, he was told that he was the Son of God, that he made himself to be the Son of God. That's what the chief priests and the people there were saying. And so he continues on, and he's afraid. Pilate is afraid about what's going on here. He says, wait a second, why you think that you're, he says that he's the Son of God. That's kind of a big deal here. So he asks, where are you from in verse 9? But Jesus gave him no answer. Then Pilate said to him, are you not speaking to me? Do you not know that I have power to crucify you and power to release you? Jesus answered, you could have no power at all against me unless it had been given you from above. Therefore, the one who delivered me to you has the greater sin. From then on, Pilate sought to release him, but the Jews cried out, saying, if you let this man go, you are not Caesar's friend. Whoever makes himself a king speaks against Caesar. And so they continue to say, crucify him, crucify him. And so we find that he is the more afraid. And so I'm trying to remember where we left off. It's been so long now. But I can't remember. Did we ask the question, why do you suppose Pilate was afraid?
Well, for one, given the culture you know, in the Romans pantheon, there's lots of stories in their mythology about people being sent or special emissaries from the gods, and so, you know, one, he had a real reason to fear a situation like that because they believed such things had happened.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, it's not just that, because at the same time, if you recall, his wife had dreams about this man. We find in the Gospel of Matthew, I think we mentioned that earlier on, that his wife, he had dreams about this man, and that might have convinced him or helped to convince him of Jesus' innocence. And it wouldn't be that far-fetched for this Roman to believe that Jesus might be some kind of demigod, which is the kind of thing that they had in Greco-Roman mythology. Maybe he was some kind of powerful being. And if he crucified him, what terrible things might come on, what might happen to him because of this thing. And so, if you, you know, those demigods that they had back then in the mythology, like Hercules, who was son of Zeus, right? He was a son of a god, and he was half human, half god. Now, of course, and I think, Gilgamesh is said to be like half human, half god, half something else. Doesn't make any sense. they divided him up kind of oddly, but in any event, they had this these so-called demigods, and so this is very different from what Jesus is, and because Jesus is what, 100% God and 100% man, right? He is not half of anything. He is fully God and fully man at the same time, but he has this but of course, in the mind of Pilate, how is he going to try to distinguish with that? You know, that the whole hypostatic union is the I think the fancy phrase for that idea. He's not going to understand that, but he still believes that he might be some kind of powerful being, and this may be where the Roman centurion later on in Mark chapter 15, verse 39. Gets the idea that this man is the Son of God, because he heard this saying, the people saying, he made himself out to be the Son of God. Oh, well, truly this man was the Son of God. As he says later on, he makes that confession as Jesus is on the cross. But of course, we'll get to that more when we get there. Well, after this, they tore the purple robe from his back. They tore the purple robe from his back, as we see in Mark chapter 15 and verse 20. In Mark chapter 15 and verse 20, it says, and when they had mocked him, they took off the purple, put his own clothes on him, and led him out to crucify him. So they basically had to tear off that purple robe off of his back, and they replaced his other clothes, and they lead him out to be crucified. There is no indication, of course, that they removed the crown of thorns. In any depiction that we see of Jesus on the cross, he's always wearing the crown of thorns. There's no indication that they took him off. And this took place, it says in John chapter 19, verse 14, that this takes place at around the sixth hour. But Mark records that the crucifixion occurred at the third hour. We see in in chapter 15, verse 25. Now it was a third hour, and they crucified him. So that's interesting, isn't it? How do we reconcile that? The third hour versus the sixth hour? Does that make sense? Shouldn't that be later? Isn't the sixth hour around noon? And the third hour is 9 o'clock in the morning? How could one happen after the other but happen so far ahead of? Let me explain. I see the quizzical looks. How does that make sense? It shows that John is using the Roman method of counting hours. He is counting down from midnight. So the sixth hour would be 6 a.m. All right, so this isn't noon that these things are happening. This is 6 o'clock in the morning. Of course, they're not very precise with their measurement of time. So it's around 6 o'clock in the morning. And so it takes some time for him to get to the cross. And so he is crucified. The crucifixion starts at 9 o'clock in the morning, which is the third hour according to the Jewish method, which starts at sunrise, which is about 6 o'clock. So that's how that all works out. That's how that makes sense. All right, now we get to the crucifixion. The crucifixion. Jesus is crucified. Let's go ahead, and I don't think I want to read all that just yet, but we're going to read verses 21. Well, we're going to start with verse 21 here. Then they compelled a certain man, Simon a Cyrenian, the father of Alexander and Rufus, as he was coming out of the country and passing by, to bear his cross. So he is going to Golgotha, And in Golgotha, not much is said about Jesus's arduous journey from the Praetorium to Golgotha. And so there's not, and this is what is commonly called the Via Dolorosa. Have you heard of that? That's the path of sorrows, the road of sorrows. And so this is the path that Jesus is said to have taken. The most that's said about this particular path is in Luke's gospel, and that some women were mourning, and Jesus addresses them. We see that. I have that up here in Luke 23, verses 27 through 31. Again, this isn't a study of the other of the whole gospel account, so we're not going to look at that. But we note here that, and in Matthew and Luke, that this man is mentioned, Simon the Cyrenian, Simon of Cyrene. Cyrene was on the northern coast of Libya in North Africa. So you could probably—I don't have a picture of that. You might be able to picture where that is. And so Simon was likely a Jewish man living there in Cyrene who was in Jerusalem for the Passover. And of course, that makes sense. You know, this is the Passover. This is when so many people are coming to, or so many Jews especially, are coming to Jerusalem to celebrate this particular event. The Roman guards compelled Simon to help carry his cross. And most of the time, however, the condemned criminal is required to carry his own cross. That's sort of a requirement that they had back then. And it would seem that Jesus was too badly beaten to carry it on his own. And that's why we note, you know, it doesn't say exactly how bad he was beaten. None of the gospel accounts say that about how bad he was scourged and whipped and all that. It doesn't exactly say. It has some hints of it, of course, with the crown of thorns and things of that nature. But because of how terrible it was, because he wasn't able to carry his cross all the way, that indicates that the scourging was terrible, was horrific. And so that's why some people, you might hear some people say that people could see his bones. Well, again, we have no record of that, about how severe the flogging was. But we do see that since he couldn't carry his cross, that very likely was the case. That they could see his bones. It was that it pulled to that extent, the whips and the scourgings.
And he also had not had any sleep all night.
Yeah.
During this trial, so-called trial, right. And that they can't have at night. But anyway, you know, it was a very, very long 48 hours for him as a human being.
Yeah.
If nothing else, because he had no sleep. But he had all of that sorrow and pain from the scourging.
Yeah.
It was just too much.
Yeah, for those on the live stream who probably couldn't hear that, the pain from the lack of sleep, that he had. He had been up for about 48 hours by this point. He didn't have any sleep the night before. He was in anguish, all the things that had been coming up that had been leading up to this point, and just so much that he was going through may have contributed, well, I may have certainly contributed to his inability to carry that cross. So thank you, Gene, very much. So the Romans had a custom that by law, you were compelled to help with a particular matter for a certain duration if called upon. And so Jesus alludes to this at the Sermon on the Mount. If you remember all the way in Matthew chapter 5, in verse 41, the idea of going the second mile. Right. So if someone compels you to go 1 mile, go with them two. And so this is kind of the conscription, if you will, that the Romans were doing toward Simon. They said, hey, you help us. And he was compelled. He had to help them during this time because of this law. Simon may or may not have been accompanied by his two sons. We note in this verse that he was the father of Alexander and Rufus. And so he may or may not have been accompanied by his two sons. It doesn't say specifically. Because they're mentioned, it seems likely that they were there, but we don't know for certain. And if they weren't there, then he likely told them about this particular event. And it's important because the very fact that Mark names these people is an indication that you should be able to go and talk to them and ask them about, hey, Alexander and Rufus, tell us about that. Tell us what happened there that day. How did it feel to carry his cross? What did your father say about that? And Alexander is a pretty common name. We find that in several places. But Rufus we find in Romans chapter 16. So this is one of the reasons, another one of the evidences that the primary audience of the Gospel of Mark was to the Roman Christians. Alexander was in Ephesus at some point. We find that in 1 Timothy. So it's unlikely that, and he was a false teacher. So I think it's unlikely that's the same person. It could be, but unlikely. Yes.
Just a question. You know approximately how far it was from where he started until he got up to where he was crucified?
We are going to look at that in a second. Good question. Good question. He asked how far it was for him to walk. There are different ideas based on placement, and so we'll look at that in just a moment. Romans 16:13 is where Rufus is mentioned. One interesting thing that I noted, there is an ossuary. Do you know what an ossuary is? An ossuary is a small box where they kept people's bones. So they would put them in a tomb until they decayed to a certain point, and they, you know, for lack of space or maybe some other reason, they took the bones and they put them in an ossuary, this small box. And they had an inscription, this is so-and-so. Not unlike how some people have urns for people's cremated remains with them. And so somebody found an ossuary in Jerusalem that belonged to Cyrenian Jews with an inscription that read, Alexander, son of Simon. Could this be that same Alexander? Well, of course, we don't know that for certain, but I mean, that seems pretty likely. Simon is compelled to carry Jesus, help Jesus carry his cross to the place of the crucifixion. The cross was likely not the whole cross. You know, in all the depictions, you see him carrying this huge cross. It was probably not that, based on some of the evidence that we see about people and crosses and history and whatnot, shaped like a T. Probably not like that. but was just the cross beam that was carried. So you see the cross like that, and it was probably just the cross beam that was that he was carrying. And the other part was already firmly planted in the ground, and they hoisted him up once he was attached to the cross beam. So that's probably how it occurred there. All right. And then he is lifted up. He is lifted up. Turn that off. All right. He is lifted up. Let's read verses 22 through 28. And they brought him to the place Golgotha, which is translated place of a skull. Then they gave him wine mingled with myrrh to drink, but he did not take it. And when they crucified him, they divided his garments, casting lots for them to determine what every man should take. Now it was the third hour, and they crucified him. And the inscription of his accusation was written above, the King of the Jews. When, with him, they also crucified two robbers, one on his right and the other on his left. So the scripture was fulfilled, which says, he was numbered with the transgressors. All right. Golgotha is the Aramaic word for the Greek word where we get cranium. Cranium. The place of the skull. So looked a bit like a cranium. There are two locations that people give for where this might have been. Two possible locations, and I don't know how well you can see that. Probably not very well. I do have a more zoomed-in version of that in a second. So you can see that... So those are the two possible... So he starts out, if you remember when we were studying that, the starting location could have been the Praetorium, which we see on the west side of town, toward the left there. Or it could be from the Antonia Fortress, which is where a lot of people think he was, where this was likely to have occurred, where these kinds of things likely occurred. And so we see the traditional location for the crucifixion right here. And so let's look at the more blown up version of that. Probably a little easier to see on the on the video. But these are the two locations that people give for where this place might have been. There are two locations. This is the first location. So there is this traditional location upon which the Eastern Orthodox Church is built called the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And so that's, again, the traditional location. And so we can see that. That's a... I want to turn out a light. oh, you got it? Thank you. And so that's one, that's the picture that we see of the church that they have up there on that particular location. And the other is a hill that is a rock formation. And so there's that one. There we go. So there's that one location, and here's another location. So it could have been either of those two origin points to this location way out here. Both of them had to be outside the city. Now, that doesn't look like it's outside the city, I suppose, but back when Jesus was crucified in around 30 AD or so, this was outside the city. So it had to be outside the city from what we understand in certain places. And we see that it could have been up here. So there's that secondary location that some people have. This, now, I want you to look at this for a second. This is it's up there. You probably can't read that, but it says Gordon's Calvary, which is a guy by the name of Gordon said, hey, this might be it. So that's why it's called that up there. Now, one of the reasons why this is a possible location is here's how it looks. You can see... two eyes, kind of a nose and a mouth right there. It looks kind of like a skull. Now, granted, this is a little farther away. How about if we zoom in on that a bit? Oh, that looks a bit like a skull, doesn't it? You can see one of the reasons why people might think this was a location for the crucifixion. All right. So,
you know, I've always been a little curious as to why, when everything else is precise in history and in locations and stuff, why this particular one is still in question.
Well, there's actually quite a few that are in question on that sort of thing. Well, you know, 2,000 years, lots of time happened, and people didn't think it was worthy enough to note the exact location. Now, of course, we see that the gospel writer said the place of the skull, so the people knew where that was back then, obviously, or else he might have given more precise indications of that. But as time progressed, people just forgot. So here's the possible location right here, the place of the skull. So that might answer your question, Alvin, earlier about the distance for how far he had to travel. Now, of course, these arrows indicate as the crow flies. So there, of course, there are roads. So it's going to be a bit longer than this. But you see that possible distance. It could be, this is probably the longest one here, from the Praetorium to the west to Gordon's Calvary up there, whereas the shortest is probably this one here, from the Praetorium to the traditional location. So it could have been very long, it could have been very short.
Yeah, I don't think it could be. I mean, I carried a lot of 4x4s 10 foot long, and I could do about a football field, and that's just about it.
Yeah, and so we might remember the football field. Do you remember how big the football field was compared to the temple? About half or so?
It was about 70 yards or 80 yards or something like that.
Yeah, so that's about half of that, I guess, roughly.
You're looking... As the crow flies, half a mile to a mile.
Yeah.
But, you know, all kinds of things. One thing to remember, besides just the roads, and it's mountainous terrain, right? It's hilly terrain. They're going up and down hills. There's a reason why they did public executions. They're two robbers, right? Not great, huge, famous insurrectionists, you know. Two robbers. They did public executions to tell everybody else, don't do this. You know, and so a lot of times, and the Romans were really good at this, they marched the people around town. They want people to see. Here's what happens to the thief. Here's what happens to the person who says he's king.
Yeah.
You know, so there's, it doesn't mean that they took the shortest path.
Yeah. Yeah. But another part of it is that they likely would have wanted to choose a place that was highly trafficked. And because they want to set an example, right? They want people to see this. So that puts it more toward this traditional location, because here was the borders of the city at the time. And so that's a little bit more public than way out here. So, you know, there's those different possibilities, about where it could be. Of course, this assumes, you know, for the place of the skull, for that mountain that looks a little bit like skull shaped, that assumes that it looked like that 2,000 years ago. and you know, it may have, but, you know, with erosion and what mankind likes to do to things sometimes, it may not have.
And all you have to do is read Josephus, the earthworks. That and the earth moving that went on during the Romans' siege of Jerusalem were massive. They filled in valleys. I mean, they did a bunch of stuff. So the whole thing could have been leveled. It could have been covered over. You know, you just don't know.
Yeah. So, that's right. So let's see. I think there was something else I wanted to mention. Oh, the traditional, if you go to Israel, the traditional Via Dolorosa, I found, is from the Antonia Fortress to the traditional location. That's the, if you follow that path, if you follow that on their tours, whatnot, then that's where it'll take you. So if that adds any weight for you about likely locations. Okay. In any event, he was outside the city. The Old Testament law commanded concerning the bull and the goat sacrifices on the Day of Atonement that they were to be burned up outside the camp. We see that in Leviticus 16, verse 27, and Hebrews 13, and verse 12, where it says that he was crucified outside the camp. And so we see that there. Both of these locations are outside the limits, the city limits in AD 33. So we saw that they were outside the city limits. And there were some people nearby, perhaps guards, who offered him a painkiller. That's what that was. The wine mingled with myrrh was supposed to be some kind of painkiller. But he chose not to take it. He chose to suffer. He was going to suffer. Then they ripped off his garments yet again. The clothes that he had been wearing, they ripped them off, opening up those old wounds from the scourging. Old, it was just a few hours ago. Those being crucified in the Roman Empire were typically crucified naked to enhance their humiliation. He is typically depicted in, as we see up there, typically depicted as wearing a loincloth. Partly for modesty's sake, you know, we don't want to have that pictures of all that. But it's possible that he was wearing a loincloth. Sometimes the Romans made certain concessions for particular things, for particular customs of the time. And so it's possible that he was wearing one in deference to the Jewish laws on modesty. It's possible. While he was being crucified, they cast lots for his clothes to decide on who got what. They didn't want to tear any of it. Let's get to that again. They didn't want to tear any of it because, it was decent enough, I suppose. Perhaps a bit bloody, but they could get that out. I suppose they could get that out. Did they have that technology back then? I'm not sure. They cast lots. They didn't want to tear it, and they fulfilled the prophecy found in Psalm 22, a psalm that Jesus would later quote in verse 34. We find some more information on that in John 19, verse 24, and Psalm 22 in verse 18, where that's the passage that's being fulfilled at that moment, Psalm 22, 18. The third hour had come when they crucified him, which is about, again, 9 a.m. by our counting. It's the third hour past sunrise. They had hoisted the crossbeam onto the stake after nailing his hands and wrists into it. We find that in John chapter 20 and verse 25. Then they nailed his feet, both of them together, on the cross. They put up an inscription that said, "The King of the Jews," according to Mark's account. Luke reveals it was in Hebrew, in Latin, and in Greek. They would often attach to the cross the crime by which one was being crucified. And they committed and whatever crime it was as a warning. Hey, don't be like this guy. Don't be, as Sam mentioned earlier, don't do what this guy did. This will be the outcome. Combining all the accounts that we see, so we see this is mentioned in all four gospel accounts. The inscription read, "This is Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews," which suggests that Mark's reading is perhaps an abbreviated version of what was written. We know that this is Jesus of Nazareth, but the accusation was the King of the Jews. In any event, the only crime he was really guilty of was being King of the Jews. not a thief, not a murderer, not anything of that nature. Was this a true statement? Was he the king of the Jews? More than that, he was the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. And they crucified him. They killed him. And then we see that the King of the Jews had two thieves crucified on either side of him. Perhaps Barabbas' accomplices, perhaps not. And he was again numbered with the transgressors, as we can see there in verse 28. We find there that there is more mockery that happens in verses 29 through 32. And those who passed by blasphemed him, wagging their heads and saying, "Aha, you who destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross." Likewise, the chief priests also, mocking among themselves with the scribes, said, "He saved others, himself he cannot save. Let the Christ, the King of Israel, descend now from the cross, that we may see and believe." Even those who were crucified with him reviled him. Jesus, he suffered even more indignity as he was hanging there on the cross. Of course, that was the point of crucifixion, wasn't it? The point was to suffer humiliation of the very slow and very public death. They blasphemed him, which is to say they spoke evil against him. They wagged or shook their heads while speaking such evil things against him. They must have heard the false accusations that were made against Jesus in his trial, as we see in chapter 14 in verse 58 before the Sanhedrin, about being you who said you would destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, that kind of thing. They must have heard that accusation. They must have been reminded of it at some point. Or they remembered it in general. Or perhaps, again, they remembered it all the way back in John 2, verse 19, when he made that claim. You know, I'm so glad that Jesus said that they could be forgiven for blaspheming against the Son, as we see all the way in Mark chapter 3 and verse 28. I'm so glad that that could happen, that he said that. That, yeah, you can blaspheme against the Father and the Son, and you could be forgiven. I'm so glad, because I'm sure 3,000 of them were also glad, as we see in Acts chapter 2, when they heard the gospel from the mouths of Peter and the other apostles. They were trying to goad him into coming down off of that cross himself. Could he do that? Could he come off that cross by himself? Of course he could. He's the Son of God. Look at all the miracles that he was able to do during his time on this earth. Was he able to come off that cross? Yeah. Would have been a very simple matter. Was he going to? Why not? He had a purpose. He had a job to do. That was his whole reason for being here. What do we read the thematic verse of Mark chapter 10, verse 45? He came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many, right? That's why he came. That's why he came. And he prayed for his Father's will to be accomplished. We saw in the very last, in the chapter before this, not his own will, in chapter 14 and verse 36. In that prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane. I mean, he could walk on water. Surely he could have come off that cross without any problem. But I'm going to leave with this, because we're out of time. What would have been the greater miracle? What would be the greater miracle? To come down off that cross, or to be raised again 3 days later? which one would have been better? After such a horrific death. The disciples later on will find in chapter 16, they didn't believe the reports that he had been raised from the dead. Why wouldn't they have believed it? Well, first off, many of them, well, at least some of them, saw his death. They knew that crucifixion was a horrible way to die. They knew that nobody comes back from that. I mean, sure, you might be able to heal a little girl who was sick and on her deathbed, but could you heal and resurrect somebody from a death on the cross? Which would have been more amazing?
I would have hated to have been that centurion guarding the tomb.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah, we'll talk about that more when we get to that resurrection. But yeah, that's falling like dead men, it says in Matthew 28. But Letha is exactly right. Which is more miraculous? Is it the coming down off that cross, or is it being raised again 3 days later after such a horrific death on the cross? All right, I'll leave you with that point. We still have a little bit left to do here in Mark 15 before we get to these final moments of Christ on the cross. We see in verses 33 through 36. All right, thank you for your attention, and we'll start a new live stream in a little bit for our worship. And again, we'll see you in a bit.